Okay, and before, now I want to show, tell you a little bit about these different limiting cases in order so that you see how this fits into the general picture, the general physical picture. So these causal fermion systems are an abstract mathematical framework where you can describe quantum geometry. You have this causal action, as I already mentioned, so you can write down equations. You can minimize this action, so you have like a geometric framework for doing geometry and analysis. And then there's this so-called continuum limit, which is like a limiting case where these quantum space-time goes over to a classical space-time, like Minkowski space or a Lorentzian manifold. And in this limiting case, one gets Dirac fields, one gets an interaction in terms of strong and electroweak gauge fields, and one also gets a gravitational field. And I should say that at this stage, the Dirac field is described in a second quantized form, whereas the bosonic field is just classical. So this is a setting where second quantized Dirac fields interact via classical gauge fields. So this is the continuum limit. Okay, in particular, since in this continuum limit one has the Dirac equation, I mean, this is like a many particle theory. If you consider just one Dirac particle, you get the Dirac equation. If you take the non-relativistic limit, then you get the Schrödinger equation. So as a specific limiting case, one gets quantum mechanics back. Okay, so this was the continuum limit. One can go one step further. There is like an effect or a mechanism called microscopic mixing. And if one takes this into account, one gets like an interaction via second quantized bosonic fields. So in this case, one gets really like the loop diagrams. One has to renormalize. And I should say that the details of this are not yet worked out, but in any case, so this is some kind of relativistic quantum field theory, or to be more specific, like perturbative quantum field theory. Okay, so you get like quantum field theory as a limiting case in this sense. And maybe I should also mention this description in the continuum limit. One has, in this description, one has like classical gauge fields. So as this one has like Young-Mills theory, like general relativity, so these classical theories, also classical field theory also comes up here. Okay, and maybe just a bit more now on the on the general structure of the equations. I mean, in the end, the equations of quantum mechanics and of quantum field theory are linear, of course. So you have linear operators acting on a Hilbert space or on Fock spaces, but this linearity comes up only in a limiting case. And if you do not perform this limiting case, then the description, the continuum limit is nonlinear, of course, like since you have like here nonlinear Young-Mills, Einstein equations, and so on. And in fact, like the action principle considered here, like on the lowest level, on the microscopic level, this is also nonlinear. So here the whole setup is nonlinear. The underlying microscopic equations are also nonlinear, and the linearity only appears in a certain limiting case. Okay, so it's maybe so much for this general setup or for the, how this connects to other to conventional physics. Now let me explain what a causal fermion system is. And I don't want to bombard you with the abstract definition, but instead I will lead you towards this definition by starting with a simple example. And maybe just in general terms, one idea is that a space-time point is not just a point of a set, but a space-time point is a linear operator on a Hilbert space. So the space-time points themselves are linear operators. So every space-time point is a linear operator. So this is really different from like quantum mechanics. There you also have like these position operators like x, y, z, but these are just three operators and they describe the whole space. Here it's different because at every point of space-time has its own operator. Okay, and so this is like what we want to do. And of course, the first thing we need is a Hilbert space, and we need a collection of linear operators on H. And this is something I want to explain you now in a simple, in the simplest possible example, in a simple example, step by step, so that you see how do the objects come up, which we will see again in the general definition of a causal fermion system. So let's take as our starting point Minkowski space. And then our task is to associate to every point of Minkowski space, every point in R4, a corresponding operator f of x. Okay, we consider Dirac spinners, more precisely just the free Dirac equation, as you all, which you probably all know. And the Dirac spinner, so this is just like a four-component complex wave function, so no second quantization here, just this classical Dirac wave function. Then there's a corresponding probability density associated to that. And if you integrate this probability density over space, this gives you a conserved quantity, and in fact, that gives you a scalar product. So if you take psi psi, this is just, or here the integrand, here psi bar gamma zero psi, so this is the probability density for the particle described by the wave function psi to be at position x. And if you polarize this and integrate this, then you get the corresponding Hilbert space. And this is the same Hilbert space which is always used in Dirac theory, or which in the non-relativistic limit goes over to the usual L2 of R3 Hilbert space in quantum mechanics. Okay, so we have this Hilbert space, and now we consider a collection of one particle wave functions. So we just take a finite number, say for simplicity, of such wave functions, which should be solutions of the Dirac equation. Okay, and right now I'm not, might say, well, but this is not the way how one should describe a many particle state. So you should take the wedge product of all these wave functions to get a corresponding Fock state. This is something I'll come back later to. For the moment, we just take these one particle wave functions and we orthonormalize them. And then what one can do if you fix a fixed space-time point x, that we form these so-called local correlation matrix. So we consider the inner product of the spinners at a given space-time point x. And then here on the left and on the right, we can put in our basis vectors. And in this way, one gets like an f by f matrix. So this is like a big matrix, like the rank of this, or the so the number of rows and columns is as big as the number of particles which I have. So this is a Hermitian F by F matrix. And moreover, this matrix has rank at most 4. So the rank is much smaller. And how does this come about? Like one, mathematically speaking, you can say this is a Gram matrix, so a matrix of inner products. And for such matrices, the rank is at most as large as this, the dimension of the space where you take the inner product of. You can also do it a bit differently. You can write this f of x as an operator ex star times ex, and ex just maps the wave function to the wave function at the point x. So the point is that you evaluate the spinner at a given space-time point, and then you have like a four-component spinner. So you have to only have like 4 degrees of freedom. And then if you take inner products, this will be a matrix of rank at most 4. And moreover, the number of positive and negative eigenvalues of this matrix, they encode the signature of this inner product here. So this is not a this is not positive definite. So it has like signature 2-2. The reason is that the matrix gamma 0 comes up if you write this out in detail. So this is like an indefinite inner product of signature 2-2. And as a consequence, this matrix F has at most 2 positive and at most 2 negative eigenvalues. Okay, now so this means maybe just as a remark, you can also do this a bit nicer, basis independent. Namely, what you do is you represent the spin scalar product in terms of the Hilbert space scalar product, and then this f of x comes up as kind of the signature operator. So this is the so-called local correlation operator. And maybe I should have said, what do these entries of this matrix mean? If you look at the diagonal entries, so we have the same wave function here on the left and on the right, then this is nothing but the mass density of the jth particle at the space-time point x. Now, if you take here two different indices, this tells you about the correlation of the two wave function at this space-time point, and this is where the name local correlation matrix comes from, or if you do this basis independent, a local correlation operator. Okay, this means that now to every space-time point, we associate a linear operator f of x, and this is a linear operator with the properties that it's self-adjoint, has rank at most 4, and it has at most 2 positive and at most 2 negative eigenvalues. Okay, and now we write this as a mapping now. Basically, until now, the space-time point x was fixed. Now we vary the space-time point, and then we get a mapping which maps Minkowski space into the set of linear operators, which are denoted by curly F. So these are all linear operators of rank at most 4, with at most 2 positive and 2 negative eigenvalues. So this is like, it's not a vector space, but it's like a topological space, a subspace of the bounded linear operators on the Hilbert space. And in this way, now we can map Minkowski space into this set of operators. Okay, now the general idea is that we kind of forget what is on the left. So we want to work exclusively with the objects on the right. So this is the basic idea. And in this way, you no longer need to talk of Minkowski space or of a Lorentzian manifold. Instead, you only have this collection of linear operators.
Yeah.
Sure.
So what you call the wave functions, these are just solutions of the zero equation?
Yes, for the moment, just in this example now.
Yeah,
yes,
yeah.
Exactly. So you just take a finite number of solutions. Yeah. You just pick a finite number of solutions of a Dirac equation, and then you can perform this construction, which gives you like here, like a subset of the linear operators. Yes? No. I mean, this is generally speaking, the image of this F will only be a very small subset. And also, it does not need to be injective in general. I mean, typically, it will be an injection, but it will definitely not bijective. So it will not be surjective. Typically, yes. Okay, so this is like this general picture here. And but there is one more thing we need. Namely, if you want to speak about probabilities, we also want to integrate these probabilities over regions of space, for example, or we want to integrate things over space-time. So one needs to be able to integrate here on the right side. So we need an integration measure, like in mathematical terms. So we want to introduce a measure on the set of operators. And here on Minkowski space, one clearly has a measure, so just this measure d4x, like the usual integration measure. And now the method is to take the push forward, as mathematicians call it, of this measure. And this is something very simple. Let me explain how this goes. Suppose you take a set omega, a subset of curly F, and you want to associate to this set a volume. So what should the volume be? You take the pre-image of F, then you get a subset of Minkowski space, and then you just take the usual space-time volume of this. Mind, this is like what I wrote here. You integrate over the pre-image, take the usual volume measure. Okay, this is the so-called push-forward measure, and this is a measure on curly F. Okay, and the good thing about working with this measure is that the measure also encodes what the image of F is. So as I just mentioned, so this image will generally be like a small subset of curly F. And this small subset can be recovered as the so-called support of the measure. So you just look at those points, intuitively speaking, where the measure is non-zero, and this determines you a subset and the support of the measure, and this is then what will be space-time later on. Okay, so this is like the idea. So the resulting structure is, so we have a measure on curly F, so a measure on this set of linear operators, and the support of this measure distinguishes a subset of curly F. Okay, and this is how we want to describe Minkowski space. Okay, and before really giving you the general definition, I wanted to maybe explain something what is already an advantage you can see already at this stage. Suppose you want to describe a space-time lattice. So we start here with a four-dimensional lattice. Then we can also choose some wave functions on this lattice. And then we do the same construction. So we take the push-forward measure of the measure on the lattice. Well, on this lattice, one has just a counting measure. So one counts how many points are in a certain set. This defines a measure. And then the push-forward measure will be like a discrete measure, which then describes like a discrete space-time. And again, we want to forget about the left side. So the resulting object is we have now a discrete measure on curly F. You can also do this in curved space time. Maybe just show you a few pictures. Suppose you start on a globally hyperbolic manifold, say. You again choose solutions of a Dirac equation. Then you take the push forward of the volume measure on the Lorentzian manifold. Again, this gives you like here a measure on F, and then we forget about the right side and of the left side, and this is the resulting structure. Okay, now let me now give you the general definition, which hopefully it's already clear how this works. So we start with a Hilbert space. Then we are given a parameter n, the so-called spin dimension, which in the example of Dirac spinners is just 2. We construct curly F as the set of all bounded linear operators which are self-adjoint, have finite rank, and have at most n positive and at most n negative eigenvalues. Then we consider a measure on curly F, the so-called universal measure, and the resulting structure is a causal fermion system. And here's like a picture which would illustrate how this could look like. So the measure does not need to be either continuous or discrete. It could have a like more complicated form where parts of space-time are continuous, parts of space-time are discrete. Okay, so this is how it looks like. What's the advantage of doing this? Well, this is something, of course, I want to explain you in what follows. Maybe just to give you a few keywords. I mean, first of all, it's possible to describe spinners on singular spaces. So suppose you have like an object which is not a manifold because it has edges and corners and so on. Then doing this construction, one can still speak of spinners and one has parallel transport and connection and curvature and all of this. And this is explored like in a paper which I wrote together with Nikki Kamran last year. And moreover, one can consider ultraviolet regularized spacetimes. And this is in fact quite similar to what Achim Kempf told us in his talk. Namely, in his language, this ultraviolet regularized would be the same as band limited. So like in his talk, he said, okay, we take instead, we do not consider all the solutions of the Laplace equation or whatever, but we only pick those for which the momentum is not too large, because this is like what determines our bandwidth. Now we could take as our wave functions, just those. So we just take as this psi 1 to psi f, which we had earlier, we just take this, those wave functions with a certain band width. And then we do this construction, and then we end up with a causal fermion system in which the regularized objects are considered as the fundamental objects. So really like the basically like this regularized space-time with a band width. This is then considered as the fundamental object of the theory. And the nice thing is that here in this setting, we have a framework for doing analysis and geometry in this setting. And this is something I want to explain a little bit. And I want to begin for this audience here with kind of a more little bit information theoretic point of view. Namely, what is the setting then? I mean, suppose like we start from a causal fermion system. So we have like our measure on the Hilbert or measure on this linear operators on the Hilbert space, then this encodes a lot of information. Namely, to every point x in the support of the measure, say, we can compute its eigenvalues. We can also take operator products, so we can multiply the operator describing one spacetime point with the operator at another spacetime point, and then we get a new operator. We can again compute its eigenvalues. So then, in this way, you get like many functions on F, and then we have also this measure to our disposal. This means whatever functions we have, we can integrate them over space-time, we can integrate them over subsets of space-time, and this gives in this way we can get a lot of information. You can say, okay, a lot of information is encoded in this causal fermion system. But I should say that right now, the connection to information theory remains to be developed, so there is no right now, there's no operational point of view. I mean, in many talks this week, so this operational point of view was important. So there's an observer who has some local information on the system. So this is something one could do here, but this has not been worked out. Also, there's no definition of entropy, temperature, and all these kind of more macroscopic quantities here. So this is something which has not been done. So I also cannot talk about this. But what I want to do is I want to try to bring all this information into a useful form. And by useful, I just mean that we recover structures which are familiar, like space-time, wave functions, curvature, and so on. And let me explain a little bit how this goes. So again, like to make this point clear, so the space-time points, so if we start with the causal fermion system, we define space-time as the support of the measure. And in this way, every space-time point is a linear operator on H. And then we can consider eigenspaces, we can project onto eigenspaces, we can all do all kinds of constructions. And it turns out that this really gives like rise to quantum objects like spinners, wave functions, geometric structures, and also causal structure and analytic structures. How does this work? Let's begin with the causal structure, because to my view, this is the most important structure. So this is like what gave rise to the name causal fermion system. So how does this work? Suppose we take like two space-time points. So these are two linear operators of rank at most 2n. So if I multiply two such operators, I again get an operator of rank at most 2n. So it's like a finite rank operator. But this operator will no longer be self-adjoint in general, because if I take the adjoint of the operator product, the two operators are flipped. And since they do not need to commute, so this will not be a self-adjoint operator in general. This means if you now compute the eigenvalues, so the zeros of the characteristic polynomial, these eigenvalues will in general be complex. And this gives rise to the following definition. Namely, one says that the two space-time points are time-like separated if the eigenvalues are all on the real axis, space-like separated if they are all not real and all have the same modulus, and light-like separated otherwise. And right now, this is just a mathematical definition. It's not clear, does this make any physical sense? But this is something we'll see in what follows. And first of all, this is just like an abstract definition of what we mean by a causal structure. Okay, now next, I want to explain you what the causal action principle is. I mean, this is kind of the, to me, like the most important ingredient here, which makes it possible to really write down some equations. So this is like the part which kind of took most time to develop, because it was not so clear how should this action look like and so on. So how does this work? So if I take two points x and y, so again, consider these eigenvalues of this operator product. These are in general complex numbers. Then I take their absolute values, take their differences, and sum over all of the eigenvalues. So here x and y are fixed. So this is just a non-negative number which is associated to any pair of space-time, to any pair of points. Okay, and now the action is to integrate this Lagrangian with respect to the universal measure. This gives me a non-negative number. And now I minimize S under variations of the measure, imposing suitable constraints. I mean, there are some constraints which are needed for mathematical consistency, and they also have a physical interpretation and so on. But I mean, I don't have time to enter to explain this. Also, it's not so important for understanding the general kind of this general strategy here. So what is important is that the measure, this is like the object which is varied. So the measure is like kind of my physical object, and I minimize this action under variations of this measure. Okay, yes?
How is this action connected to the original action either in the space or in the space?
Well, not directly. I mean, this is why it took so long to come up with this. It has really a completely different structure. But it turns out that in the end, if you look at certain limiting cases, then you get back, for example, the Young-Mills action and the Einstein-Hilbert action and so on. But this is not obvious. Okay, and why is it called causal action? The reason is that the Lagrangian is compatible with this causal, with the causal structure. Namely, if we go back here, we said like if two points are space-like separated, then the eigenvalues all have the same modulus. And if this happens, then this Lagrangian obviously vanishes, because then all the summands here, all these differences, they are all zero. So if you have space-like separated points, according to our definition, then the Lagrangian vanishes. And even more, also like the first variations vanish, so the Euler-Lagrange equations vanish. In other words, points with space-like separation do not interact. So this is like how causality comes up and how also this notion of causality is tied to the interaction of the system. And let me make this a little bit more precise, since we have been talking about these different notions of causality, for example, in the discussion yesterday. What is the picture here? So there are causal relations. So there's distinction between space-like and time-like. There even is a direction of time. So we can speak of future and past. Also, locality holds in the sense that Gerard Toft pointed yesterday. So if you take space-time region with space-like separation, they have an independent dynamics because they are not connected to each other via the Lagrangian. So this is like what I mean by locality here. But this relation lies in the future of is not necessarily transitive. So this means also there's no causation. So you can't say I start here at time zero and then I proceed going into the future. This is not how the equation, what the structure of the equations is. And here lies in the future of is not necessarily transitive. You can understand this on the microscopic scale. There might be something like close time-like curves, if you like this or not. I mean, this is like how it comes out here. And later on, I mean, if you take the connection to Minkowski space or so, this is then the stage where this transitivity comes up. So this is like, therefore, the picture here is that on the microscopic scale, you can still speak of locality and causal relations, but not necessarily of a transitive notion of lies in the future of. But if you then go to macroscopic scales, then one does have this transitivity. And then on the whatever cosmological scale, well, as we discussed yesterday, there might be like this closed time-like curves, and then there's no transitivity anymore. Okay, so this is like how the what I mean by causality here. And now let me explain a bit more what other inherent structures come up. And I know, I mean, this is like, these are now a whole bunch of definitions, each of which is not so difficult, but I know that in a talk, it's always difficult to digest too many notions at once. So therefore, this is intended more to give you like an impression of what's going on here, and maybe also to see how it works in principle. So first of all, how do spinners come up? Well, a space-time point is a linear operator. So what you can do is you just consider the image of this operator. This is like a finite dimensional subspace of the Hilbert space of dimension at most 2n. So this means to every space-time point, you can associate such a finite dimensional vector space. And then on this vector space, one introduces this following scalar product. I mean, the simplest idea would be to just take the Hilbert space scalar product, but this turns out not to be such a good choice. It's better to put the operator itself as the signature operator here. And if you do this, then you have an indefinite scalar product and of signature, well, at most n positive, at most n negative. Directions. Okay, so this is now similar to the kind of a spinner bundle. But the underlying space does not need to be, a manifold. So it's like a more general structure, but at each space-time point, you have like a spin space. Then one can also introduce wave functions, just abstractly, they form a Krein space. Maybe that's not so important here, but what's important is that there are also physical wave functions. What does this mean? If I take a vector of my Hilbert space, then I can, and I take a space-time point x, then I can project this vector onto the subspace. And this I can do for every space-time point. So for any space-time point x, I can project a given vector of the Hilbert space onto the subspace. And this defines me a wave function, a specific wave function. So this means in this setting, out of this, in the space of all wave functions, there is a distinguished subset, this so-called physical wave function. And one can also introduce like this kernel of the fermionic operator, maybe just so that you see what this is. This is something like you sum over all over a basis of the Hilbert space, and you sum over these bracket combinations of all the physical wave functions. And this is like something which in the Minkowski limit gives rise to a two-point distribution, the so-called fermionic projector. And this, in fact, was the starting point, like in this book from 2006, which, in fact, I can no longer recommend because in the meantime, things have developed, and I think it's better to look at more recent papers. But just to mention, so this is like this was the starting point. In this paper, also this causal action is introduced. Okay, now what about geometric structures? What is the idea here? So the idea is, if you take this fermionic projector, this is a mapping from one spinner space to another spinner space. So in other words, it gives connections, relations between different spin spaces or between different space-time points. And out of this operator, you can then construct a unitary operator, which is the spin connection. And maybe that just the idea is to use a polar decomposition. But in fact, it's more subtle than that. This is why I put here dot, dot. I can also introduce a tangent space, which carries a Lorentzian metric and gets a corresponding metric connection. And these two connections should be compatible. This is precisely what this dot, dot, dot here is all about. Then there's a distinguished time direction, and curvature is obtained as the holonomy of this connection. Okay, then there's also another structure which is built in, is here local gauge freedom. Let me just mention this. I mean, what is the idea is simple. I mean, we have now this spin space. It's like at every space-time point, we have like this subspace. And now if you want to write down wave functions in components and so on, then one has to choose bases. And if you choose a pseudo-orthonormal basis of the spin space, then you can represent a wave function in components. But the point is that this basis is not unique. I mean, at every space-time point, at each space-time point, you can choose a different basis. And this gives rise to local transformations of the wave functions. And the matrix U of X coming up here is then a unitary matrix with respect to the spin scalar product. So in other words, we have like a certain gauge group which comes up naturally here. Okay, I'm not so sure. There are like 5 more minutes. Is this okay? Is this correct? Or 6? Well, okay, then let me just mention, like, what about the Pauli exclusion principle? Right at the beginning, I started just with F, one particle wave function. So you might wonder, how does the Pauli exclusion principle come up? But it does come up automatically, because all that matters later on is the subspace of the Hilbert space spanned by all these one particle wave functions. So what we are working with effectively is a subspace of the one particle Hilbert space. And this subspace can be described equivalently by choosing a basis and taking the wedge product of all the basis vectors. And if you do this, due to the anti-symmetrization, this is independent of which basis you choose up to a complex prefactor. So this is like really one-to-one correspondence between subspaces and Hartree-Fock states. Then this local gauge principle, I already said something, maybe just the equivalence principle. Maybe so the point is that the setting here is much more general than a manifold. We have only a topological measure space. So therefore, everything is certainly invariant under even homeomorphisms. Or if you then take a limiting case of Minkowski space or Lorentzian manifold, it will definitely be invariant under diffeomorphism. So therefore, all these principles are kind of built in. And in fact, the whole mathematical framework is designed in such a way that these principles show up. On the other hand, locality, causality, and the time direction are emergent structures. Okay, maybe now just give you a very brief idea, how do you get the connection to Minkowski space? And this works as follows. Suppose you start from Minkowski space and you just want to describe Minkowski space in the setting of causal fermion systems. Then what one does is one takes this picture of the Dirac C literally. So we start with all the negative energy solutions of the Dirac equation. And then we need to introduce an ultraviolet regularization. in the simplest case, just the momentum cutoff. And then you have like a finite number of states, or maybe an infinite number of states. The whole setting also works in the infinite dimensional setting. And doing this fixes the length scale. And then, so we just take the, all these states here as the solutions of the Dirac equation, which we had at the very beginning of this talk, and construct the corresponding causal fermion system. And it turns out that if you do this, and consider the, so this scale epsilon is the regularization scale, that then the resulting causal fermion system encodes all the information of Minkowski space in the limit epsilon goes to zero. This means like if you remove the regularization, you get all the usual structures back, namely the causal structure goes over to that of Minkowski space. These spin spaces can be identified with the usual spinner spaces. The spin connection becomes trivial, and in particular, in this limiting case, the relation lies in the future of becomes transitive, so we can really come like a the usual notion of causality and causation. For example, why does, how does causation come up? Well, because for the Dirac equation, the Cauchy problem is well posed. So if you start with initial data, there's a unique solution to the future. So this is then where the usual kind of notions of causality come up, and where you see the connection to the notions on the causal fermion system. Okay, maybe I skip this. Maybe just to finish, one can also now study interacting systems. And the way this works is that one needs to, first of all, prescribe what the vacuum should be. So the vacuum is then a minimizer of this causal action principle, and you need to specify how this looks like. So you need to say, which fermionic particles come up, which masses do they have, how many generations are there, and so on. So this is like where one has to put in a lot of knowledge about our space-time. But you do not say anything about the interaction here. So you just say, how does the vacuum look like? And then, okay, this is, maybe I skip this. You can also do this in order to describe the fermion configuration of the standard model. And then it turns out that if you then look at the corresponding interacting system, so what you do is you perturb the system in a very general manner and ask, when are the Euler-Lagrange equations corresponding to the causal action satisfied? And then it turns out that they are satisfied only if the perturbation can be described by bosonic fields, by classical bosonic fields, which have the type of gauge potentials, and you get the correct gauge groups and the correct coupling to the fermions, and one gets the Einstein equations. Okay, I think my time is over, so thank you very much for your attention.
I understand that those results are somehow like done by reverse engineering. So in principle, we know what the equations should we get when we have already the space-time picture. So we can work out what should be precise assumptions on this causal fermion system side. My question is like, do you have any hints or ideas about genuine principles for causal fermion systems to produce predictive theories? For example, imagine that I tell you that, oh, actually SU5 with some strange stuff was verified. But this is just an example. I don't care about SU5.
Yes.
I think that I'm just wondering, like, whether you have some gut feeling or imprecise insights, or how one could attack this general concept of causal fermion system and those additional structures to produce specific predictive models.
Okay, so very good question. I mean, maybe I should say that there are maybe just a few words on how this general method works. So I mean, I have like this, suppose I have prescribed the vacuum state. Then the way I perturb is that I put a general potential here into the Dirac equation. which does not need to satisfy any field equation. So I can put anything. I could put in the gauge field corresponding to any other gauge group and so on. And then I analyze for which potentials are the Euler Lagrange equations still satisfied. And this rules out or singles out very specific types of potentials, maybe those corresponding to specific gauge groups, and also gives you the corresponding field equations. So how do these fields couple to the fermions? So therefore, the freedom is to specify the vacuum. So if you come up and say, OK, I want another gauge group, then my question would be, what is the corresponding configuration of the vacuum? And there is some freedom to play with. I mean, for example, this is like how we describe the vacuum in the, which then gives rise to the standard model gauge group. So you can take certain direct sums of Dirac C combinations that I take here, 7 identical direct sums. This is like what is responsible for this SU3 cross SU2 cross U1, which you get in the end. But there is not much freedom here. I mean, there's basically just the question, how many of these direct summons do you take? And that's all. So therefore, the whole framework is very restrictive. So you can only describe very specific gauges, very specific couplings, and so on.
And what about the choice of regularization, in the sense that do you choose such regularization that you get the result that you expect? Or if you would not, my question is like, if you would not know what is the theory that you want to get, and you just like try to work out general principles, then you would not have like specific choice of regularization that you would know to work on. My question is like, do you expect that there might be something done like 10 years later from now that should be something like some specific regularization principle also that takes, I mean like, no, that, yeah. Without fine tuning basically.
Sure, I mean, the picture is, I mean, if you, the regularization really has like a physical significance here, because like a regularized object should be the fundamental object, or it makes a difference how you regularize. And this is also a subtle issue, because like if you look at the causal action, this really depends on how you regularize. Of course, we don't know what the correct physical regularization is, because nobody knows how the structure of space-time looks like on the Planck scale. So therefore, the procedure here is to work with a general class of regularization, which should be as big, as large as possible. Of course, it should also be technically manageable, which puts some practical constraints. But I mean, we consider like a large class of regularizations. And then one has to analyze in detail how do the results of the continuum limit depend on how you regularize. Mm-hmm. And for everything to be sensible, the structure of the effective equation should not depend on how you regularize. And this is also how it turns out to be. But the values of the coupling constants and bosonic masses and so on, they do depend on the regularization. So this is also something one can do here. I mean, if you take a specific regularization, then you can really compute the coupling constant.
Actually, this gives you a chance for having more operational thing, because maybe you can operationally select the method of regularization.
Sure, I mean, this is like, yes. So my point of view is that the regularization should give to a finite, hopefully small number of empiric constants, which are just adjusts to the experiments. But hopefully these are not too many free parameters, because otherwise one loses predictability. And I should also say, I mean, of course, it's not quite satisfying that we have to put in what the vacuum structure is. One would like to understand better how do general minimizers of this causal action principle look like. And ideally, one would hope to prove something like a generic minimizer looks like a regularized Dirac C configuration. Okay, but this is not so clear. These are things we are just looking at numerically also. And in very simple examples, you can analyze this in detail. But of course, this is too simple for really being of physical interest. The problem is like with this Dirac C configuration, the number of states is very large. So the Hilbert space should be very large dimensional, say finite dimensional, but of very high dimension Hilbert space. And this, of course, makes all computations quite difficult.
I think my question is more or less related to Richard's, but maybe I'll do it more constrained. It's very interesting that you're getting the gauge group of a standard model. It's also true that you have three generations in your choice of terminals.
Yes.
Suppose you didn't have three generations.
Okay.
Would you still get the gauge group of the generation? In other words, how is the number of generations connected to the group of the standard model?
Just see, I mean, I had something, a slide on that. Yeah, here. Okay, basically like the generations are put in just by taking ordinary sums of these directions. And it turns out if you take less than three generations, then the equations are overdetermined. So there are no solutions.
Uh-huh.
So then you have no interaction, and no interaction is possible. If you have more than three generations, then they are underdetermined. So then there's no predictability anymore. And for in order to get like a kind of unique equations in the continuum limit, which is unique up to some empirical constants like the coupling constant, for example. For this, you need exactly three generations. This is something which comes out. And then concerning now the SU3 of color, I mean, this depends on how the configuration here is. I mean, maybe just briefly, so one starts with like eight direct sums, and then as a consequence of the interaction, so I mean, this is nothing we put in, so they form pairs. So then you have like four pairs, and then the SU2 acts on each of these pairs, and then you have like three of these pairs are identical because they contain all the massive fermions, and this is where the SU3 then acts. So therefore, of course, like this ansatz for the vacuum already predetermines in some sense what the resulting gauge group will be.
To understand a formalism, I'm curious to know what would happen if you started with a bunch of scalars instead of solutions to the Dirac equation, and you get rank one operators in all the space time.
Yes, I mean, this is something one could also do.
And then could you still recover the geometry from that?
Well, I'm not sure, probably not. That's what I would guess. But what you could do is, for example, you could take vector fields, or you, in the case, I think it's good to have like several components at every space time,
yeah.
Because then you get more information. But it does not need to be Spinorian. It could also be like 10 vector field, tensor fields, or something like that.
Okay.
Maybe one more question.
If anyone asks somebody else, maybe I'll give to someone else. So this is Tobias inspired question, but if you suppose that you just consider operators that have only positive eigenvalues.
Yes.
And do you know what you will get out of this?
Yeah, this is in fact something we did. I mean, this paper that we can run, which I mentioned kind of at the beginning. Anyway, I think I don't find it here. So this paper is spinners on singular spaces. So we do everything more generally. So we take an arbitrary signature, could be just positive or could have positive and negative components. And the positive case is like what you can describe the Riemannian world with. I mean, if you take the Riemannian setting or Euclidean setting.
Uh-huh.
So if you take like a spinners on a Riemannian manifold and you do this construction, then you get it with the positive definite or positive semi-definite operator.
Very, very interesting. So I would just mention maybe it might be interesting for you or not, but those finite rank positive operators are besides those that carry, if they are strictly positive, so there's still some subspace,
yes.
But if they are strictly positive, they always carry symplectic structure. Like, it's like general statement for whatever integral spaces. So it's like conjoint action from the finite structure of algebra. So it's like, that'd be useful for you to get some
synthetic
structure around.
I see, so I mean, I'll come back to you on that.
Just very quickly, for curiosity, so going to the example of the Dirac fields, can you maybe generally say that what you do is moving space-time points to something relational, where you say space-time point for me is just the correlations of fields?
Yeah, in some sense, yes. I mean, space-time is described by these local correlation operators, which just tell you how the wave functions look like.
Okay, so
the idea is that the wave functions, they really encode what space-time is and what the space-time structure is and all of this. And if you take the point of view that the wave function is what an observer has access to, so you can look where are the electrons and so on, then this is really operational.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah, so we should probably move on to the next speaker. So let's thank
you.